Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Of course, it's been a real disappointment, hasn't it, to have so many sporting events shut off to live crowds or cancelled altogether because of the coronavirus. Instead, tonight, we're going to revisit the glory age of Australian tennis. Well, we'll be joined a bit later by legend John Newcombe, but we don't just have one legend on tonight. We've got another two. Todd Woodbridge is Australian doubles champion, of course, at his best, world number 18 in singles just last week. He celebrated 30 years since his first Grand Slam doubles title. He won with Liz Smiley at the US Open. Todd, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
No, well, it's great. I'm looking forward to the conversation too. Also joining us is Casey Dellacqua. Casey reached a career singles high of world number 26, is, of course, a doubles legend, and now, these days, a sporting commentator as well. Casey, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, good evening. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us as well. We'll get to John Newcombe a bit later in the show, but first, Casey and Todd, a huge welcome, of course, and we want to just talk about the great and glory days of tennis. Why are we so good at it? Why we think we're so good at it? Todd, when you were growing up, who were your tennis heroes?
Look, I was brought up in Sydney, and I played my tennis at Illawarra Tennis Club, and Ken Rosewell had come from that part of Sydney and grown up there and played at our club, and he had a poster on the wall.
Was he known as Muscles back then?
Well, yeah, and the funny part about that is most people think he was known as Muscles because he was muscular strong. It was because he had no muscles. That was his nickname.
That's right. If you've ever met him, that's right. A smaller bird-like man you couldn't imagine. That's right.
That's right. And I had this poster that the club was getting rid of. Ken had come down to the club to give them an updated colour version, and the club gave that one to me, and it hung above my bed all of my life, basically, from about 7 years of age through to when I left home. And I've still got it rolled up. And so Ken was a great influence at the beginning of my career as a young kid.
Did you model your game on his?
Backhand a little, yes. It was always, you know, can you have the backhand of Ken Rosewell? And so there was a bit of that. But I was lucky enough too. You've got Nuke coming on later. And Nuke was very influential along with Tony Roach in my development. So I had these absolute icons and legends that I could look up to and try to chase and be as good as, but also giving their input into my own career. And I think that was hugely typical of the way Australian tennis was then.
Yeah. What about you, Casey? Who did you, when you were growing up and handling the round, who were your heroes?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I remember clearly sitting on my couch at home and watching Pat Raft win the US Open when I was about 11 or 12 years of age. And I remember sitting there with my mum and dad and just being so inspired in that moment. But then looking, I guess, a little bit down the track, I was always inspired by the people just above me, like a Renee Stubbs and Alicia Molik, people that I guess I wanted to be involved with in terms of Fed Cup. So I kind of always looked up to them as role models and to where my next step would get to. So, and have obviously become good friends with them as well, but definitely, inspired me to continue a path down tennis.
Mm. What was it? Why tennis, Casey? Well, I remember when I'm a bit older than you, but when I was growing up, of course, it was very big in Australia. Both my parents played. In fact, they kind of courted, and pardon the pun, and met it at a tennis club. It was a huge thing in Australian life, wasn't it? Was it in your family too? Where did it come from, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, I first started playing at a real local tennis club in Western Australia, Kingsley Tennis Club, and my nan and pop both played down there, and my mum and my sister, and it was a real, I guess, community family environment that I felt drawn to. And I think for me, it was all about Wimbledon growing up. I mean, obviously the Australian Open as well, but the Wimbledon, I had my room painted Wimbledon colours, green walls with purple architraves, and I just clearly... my dad was
I've always
happy.
Thought it was the most peculiar colour scheme, but anyway, go on, Casey.
No, I just had, I remember it was the one tournament that I was allowed to sit up through the night and be able to watch. And so for me, there was always this dream of always playing at Wimbledon.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's just was part of our culture, I felt, as an Australian, definitely.
Mm. What about you, Todd? I mean, I know plenty of young boys sat there in their bedroom, you know, dreaming of getting a 100 at Lords or kicking the winning goal through the sticks at the MCG in the dying minute of the game?
Well, I had a poster. I didn't go to the interior design length of Casey there. But
thank heavens for...
Yeah, no. But my memories, Philip, are of tennis being part of the social fabric of Australia. You know, I was growing up in the 70s and both my mum and dad were members of the tennis club, but it was where people socialised. So you played your tennis, then people stayed back and had beers and dinner and all of that type of thing. And that was so typical of tennis clubs all around the country. And if we go back and you look at the likes of Roy Emerson and Rod Laver, Tony Roach, all the players, Margaret Court, that grew up in the country of Australia, that was the fabric of those towns, that people all got together and played tennis. And it didn't matter what level you were, you actually played competition tennis. So you had your A grade, but you played B, C and D. It was all mixed. Kids played, adults played, and that was how I grew up. And that's what I remember so much about that time in Australia is, you know, Saturday afternoons, nobody worked. Everything shut at midday.
That's right.
And Sundays, there was no work at all. So it was about sport and it was about people getting together. And that's what's made things so much more difficult in this era when you're bringing up kids like I'm trying to do. Yeah. So that's my clear memory is that every non-raining moment was outdoors being active with tennis.
Yeah. Same for you, was it, Casey?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, Kingsley Tennis Club, and played pretty much my weekends, long weekends if there was school holidays, was spent competing, playing tournaments, playing against, you know, the older women and men, mixed doubles. Used to play with my mum a fair bit too. So, yeah, it was totally that environment. And then even coming through my development, playing into the Premier League, State League, it was still a Saturday afternoon comp, but what I looked forward to was sitting down at the end of the day and being able to chat with my, you know, my teammates and my opponents and really make a day of it. So fond memories of growing up just completely and utterly loving the sport.
Yeah, exactly. When I was a little kid, this is a generational thing too, I think, to both of you, that the big thing, you know, Wimbledon was big, of course, always, but the big thing was the Davis Cup, and you know,
very much so.
That long tradition of Australian, you know, competitiveness at the Davis Cup, and you know, my parents were, and lots of their friends were very, very passionate about it, and you know, it was a huge thing. Was that probably tailed off a bit? Was it for you, Casey, by the time you were playing?
Yeah, I always had this vision and dream of playing, representing your country, and I think when you're young. Athlete, it's the Olympic Games, but in tennis for us it was for the women was the Fed Cup, so yep. Obviously it was the ultimate, that's the pinnacle of our sport in Australia, was to represent your country. So once I got there, it's somewhere where you want to stay, and it was something that I looked forward to every year. And growing up also playing a lot of team sports, Fed Cup was the one thing that where you were allowed to be with your team and cheer each other on, and it had a totally different vibe. But obviously watching Davis Cup as well, always Davis Cup, Fed Cup, wherever Australia were competing, I was watching.
Yeah, exactly. We all were, don't worry. Todd Woodbridge and Casey Delacqua, champion players, are with us tonight. So we're talking about tennis and its role in Australian life. And it was such a big thing for generations of Australia, maybe a bit more disaggregated, and I'd like to talk about that a bit later on as well. As one half of the Woodies, though, Mark, Todd, I should say, Mark, that's a slip of the tongue, isn't it? Because with Mark...
That happens a lot. You're not the first and certainly wouldn't be the last.
I was going to say, do you get called Mark Woodbridge half the time?
Yeah, I do. It used to be funny when we were still playing, because people would often go, "Where's your brother?" And I said, "Well, not my brother.
He's not my brother."
But that used to happen all the time. But obviously, we were slightly different looking, and early on when we were having successes, but we would be out warming up and practicing. People would lean over the fence and say, "Hey, that's Woodford. Where's the other one?" And that's me. So that used to happen too, and I had the baby faced assassin look going.
Of course, with you and Mark Woodford, the famous Woodies, it's 20 years. Actually, I should make this point. It's 20 years this week, isn't it? Since you won, gold at the Olympics in Sydney. What a couple of weeks that was.
No, Phil, that was it ended up Sydney was our last tournament that we played together in 2000. That was the retirement of our partnership, and we ended up losing the final, taking home silver. 4 years before in Atlanta, we'd won gold. So that was the one. You know, it was still a brilliant experience and everything, but we fell one match short of finishing it off perfectly.
Yeah, fantastic. Todd, can we talk about the men's game for a second? And Casey, I want to come to you about the women's game too. I mean, in some ways, it's sort of unrecognisable now since the 50s and 60s. The surfaces, the rackets, the money, crowd style of play. How do players hit the ball in 2020 compared to how they were hitting it back in 1970?
It's such, it's been a big evolution, and there's been many things that have come to it. The first thing that stands out to me is the physicality of the game. So you go back to the 70s and the majority of tournaments played on grass, and particularly the Aussie style, which was serve and volley that we were all so used to. Now the game's played laterally across the baseline. But if you go back to the champions of the 60s and 70s, they were normal sized men, you would say. You had Ken Rosal was small, Laver was small, Nuke was about 6'2". He was quite tall. Now the average height of a male player out on tour is no less than 6'4". That's the average height. And then you've got these giants that are above that. So the physicality has changed.
Is it
enormously.
An advantage? Is it a mechanical advantage, do you think, to be taller? I've always thought tennis has got room for all sorts of players.
It was funny that you say that. When I was playing, we had a tall guy, we thought, oh, he can't move. No agility, he can't get down, all that sort of stuff.
Big lumbering fella, can't get around the court.
Yeah, but that's not the case anymore. These athletes are trained so well, so strong, so specific that it's very different. And I think when you look back and you go to the 70s and they're playing with wooden rackets, small heads, the strokes were very, very different. The technology has changed enormously with racket equipment, but what changed the most over the last 15 to 20 years was the string. So back in the day, you remember people used to play with cat gut, they used to call it. Natural gut was in the strings.
Yep.
And then we went on to synthetic gut, and now we have a poly type of synthetic string that can do amazing things with a tennis ball that I can hit shots and hit with the same power that I did when I was playing, and I barely play anymore. And that's really changed the dynamics of the game, and it's allowed a player like Djokovic and Nadal to be at the extremities of the court and still stay in points by the amount of spin that they can put on the ball. So it's a much harder game now to come forward than it used to be.
You started out on fake grass too, didn't you? I mean, so the surfaces have changed quite a lot. I mean, there was an awful lot of clay around.
I was in a real transition time of everything in tennis, if you like, because I grew up in Sydney and we played on loam or stabilised loam, which is like a sand court, like the clay courts of Europe.
Yep.
And they were hard to maintain and everything. And synthetic grass came in the early 80s. And so everybody went with that because it was easy to maintain. It looked good. But as a development surface and a surface for the elite in the game, you just can't play on it. It's a lovely social surface. And my game evolved a bit around that because I played a lot on it as a junior, and I didn't have the defensive game that I needed. I had to work on that.
Why can't a good player play on it?
It's very slippery. So if you start and get hit into a corner and you start running hard to get in there, you just sort of keep going that direction. It's very hard to prop and come backwards and get in. And the ball stays very low and it shoots through, and it's quite a quickish surface. So you know, that changed. Then also we started to develop hard courts, and you're playing on variation. So the other part that changed in my time was that the video technology was coming in. You could actually video yourself and watch it and tape your match and play it back. So you started to actually look at your technique very differently, because before that, very few players ever got to watch themselves and really see what they were doing and look like. You were taught and coached by feel. And so I had a real change in my era of tennis where the technique of the 60s, 70s changed. You had the old crossover where people used to land on the right foot because they served volleyed. And then you had Boris Becker come along and change the whole dynamics and physicality and biomechanics of tennis.
Casey, what about you? What surface did you start on?
Yeah, well, I am a little bit younger than Todd, so I'm probably...
Don't rub it in, will you, Kate?
No. You're young. Okay, Casey, that's right.
I thought I'd throw that in. But I was in like probably the cusp of, I still played with half natural gut and half poly. So I kind of had a lot of that older kind of feel that I really liked in my racket. But to keep up with the power and the type of shot that the players play with these days, I put half poly in. But I grew up on a lot of natural grass over in Western Australia, actually. So I grew up very, very comfortable around the net, spent a lot of time at the net, which is perhaps maybe why I loved playing doubles and had a lot of success in doubles as well. But it was, for me, it was mainly hard court or a lot of the time spent on a natural grass.
Mm. There's been a lot made of, you know, how fit women have become in the last 20 years. Do you think that's, has too much been made of this? You know, you look back in the day, Billie Jean King and others back in the earlier days of women's tennis, I mean, they were pretty fit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's no denying that. I think, like Todd said, I think in the women's game, there's no doubt the physicality of the women's game has also changed. So many players are a lot stronger. I think the big difference between the men and the women's game is around the serve, particularly. Mm-hmm. Todd mentioned the height of the men, and the men just get so many more free points off the serve, whereas the women, maybe not so much. But, for example, obviously our number one ranked player, Ash Barty, she is not overly tall, but she uses her serve so effectively. And I think there's still ways around the women's game in terms of physicality too. And there's multiple women that come to my mind over the years that have been very successful players, like a Roberta Vinci, who was short in stature but used her slice. And I think we're seeing that a little bit more in the women's game, that craftiness still play a lot of success in the women's side.
Yeah, when you see Ash Barty, number one, of course, she's brought such excitement to the game. Sometimes she reminds me of that, I don't know, a little bit of, not comparing them at all, but that there's a sort of an Australian style. Leighton Hewitt had it too. You know, you run for everything. You don't have to be the biggest person in the world, but you've got a heart as big as bigger than the tennis racket. And Ash has got plenty of that too. She's got a unique style. Is there an Australian style of tennis, do you think, in women's tennis?
I think Ash brings out a lot of the Australian kind of style of tennis that we have always perceived in our culture, you know, the ability to use the slice to move forward and, you know, all of that stuff Ash has got. And I think the one thing that Todd also mentioned that's been so crucial in Ash's career is just the ability to, she's always been a very, very smart tennis player, but to use the video technology with her coach and to be able to have a game plan. And she works players out and she gets down to the nitty gritty of exposing her opponent's weaknesses. And I think that's been a real feather in Ash's cap, that the mentality of the women's game is very important. And Ash has done a very good job over the last couple of years to really be on top of the game in that respect.
Hmm. What do you think?
Phil, it's interesting. Can I butt in?
Yeah, go on, Tom.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Because it's so important to raise the point that Casey had so much to do with the mentoring and development and actually getting Ash back into the game when she left for 12, 18 months. Hmm. But the part that Casey played such a big role in was playing doubles. And when we talk about Australian tennis history, doubles was so significant in that Australians played singles, doubles and mixed when they went to the Grand Slams. You look at Margaret's record, Rod Laver did it as well. Neil Fraser won the US Open back-to-back years, winning all three events, which is just extraordinary. But doubles was critical for the development of Australian players. And that's an interesting thing in tennis worldwide where a lot of coaches have said, well, you don't need to play that part, but skills are so important, and that's where you learn these parts. You know, Casey and Ash were runner-up in three of the four majors, or four, Casey?
All four. We did make all four. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you certainly learn to hone your volley skills in doubles, that's for sure. That is for sure. Casey, how do you rate the women's game now? Some say the men's game has become a bit boring with its endless baseline smashing. Although you see the way a player like Naomi Osaka plays, I mean, it's pretty, or Ash Barty too. We've already mentioned Ash, of course. I mean, it's hard to describe that as boring play. How do you see it?
Oh, I really enjoy the women's game, and I think what you see is very contrasting tours where the women's side, we've got a bit of depth. We're seeing, new Grand Slam champions. We're seeing new faces win our big tournaments, whereas in the men's game, you've had that real, you know, top four, five men dominate the game for so long. But yeah. I think what is exciting about the women's game is for that very reason. And, you know, Naomi Osaka, I think, is going to be one of our champions for many, many years to come. But she's a power player. She takes the ball early. But, she's already a champion at the age of 23. So I think the women's game is interesting in regards to the depth, and it, you know, that's why I was so excited to see Dominic Thiem win the US Open, just a new face for the men's game.
Yep. Yeah, exactly, exactly. All right, Casey, I know you better get to bed, actually. it's been terrific to have your time, and thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks, Todd, and thanks, Philip, and I mean, I enjoyed the chat. Thank you.
Thanks, Casey. Bye. Casey Dell'Acqua joining us there. Todd Woodbridge also with us. Todd, what about the men's game? I mean, it's a cliche to observe, isn't it? I mean, lots of people do, maybe who don't know much about tennis, they say, you know, it's such a boring smash it from the baseline game these days that the craft of it, you know, we talked about, you know, muscles, Ken Rosewall and the backhand slice shot and so on. They still use those, but an awful lot of it's just been belting the ball at the opponent with as much force as you can until somebody makes a mistake, isn't it?
True, but I think we've been in a remarkable era when you talk about Federer, Nadal and Djokovic, and I've seen and been lucky enough to commentate and call some of the most incredible matches that they've played that, for me, having played at the highest level, I look at it and just go, that's superhuman, what they've been able to do. And I think we've been spoilt in that a little bit. I think we have lost the contrast, the likes of John McEnroe serve and volleying against Bjorn Borg, who's pinning passing shots from the back of the court. And a lot like in women's tennis with Martina Navratilova playing Chris Evert, those two very distinct styles that you can attach to. But I think in most sports, it's cyclical and it tends to come around again. And with, as Casey just mentioned, Dominic Thiem winning the US Open, I think we're about to start to see those things change again as we start to sort of perhaps lose those great champions in the next 2 to 3 years as they retire.
Yeah, I don't want to diminish his achievement, but Dominic Thiem probably won because they weren't there.
Well, this is true. I mean, that's true, but you can only beat who turns up.
And, oh, no, of course,
You know, that happens. You know, I think it's worth noting a little, though, and you touched on surfaces. The majors are now become a very neutral surface where in times gone by, if you were a serve volleyer and played well on grass, like all of our greats, you would dominate at Wimbledon and the Australian Open, but you might struggle when you went to Paris on the clay, and there was real specialists in the game. Now, the surfaces play very much the same speed and a similar bounce, and because of that, we've brought more people in and probably seeing less skills than what we used to, that the forecourt skills. So that's something that has changed.
Mm. Yes, all right, okay. Todd Woodbridge is with us, champion tennis player. We're talking about tennis in Australia and what it's been. And Todd, have a cup of tea for a sec because I want to have a chat to Nuke. So
I will
come back to you in a sec. Todd Woodbridge joining us there. But I do want to talk to Nuke, of course, one of Australia's tennis legends. World number one in 1970 and 71. He was a two-time winner of the Australian Open, a three-time winner of Wimbledon, two-time winner of the US Open, and amongst many other titles, team captain of the Australian Davis Cup team from 1995 to 2000. John Newcomb, welcome to Nightlife, and thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Philip. Happy to be here.
Terrific to talk, John. Gee, I wonder whether you're glad you're not playing in this era of tennis. In your day, you didn't have to think about being on Twitter or on social media, what diet you're on, or changing a psychologist all the time.
No, it's a bit too much for me to take in. You know, we were brought up to more or less think for ourselves out there, and you know, you had your mates you talked to and that were also playing about things. And, yeah, it's a totally different thing. I think I get a bit claustrophobic with all those people around.
Yeah, it's a bubble in the way that it wasn't back then, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, especially, you know, when you finish playing at night and that, I prefer just to, you know, go and have dinner with a couple of mates or with my family. But now I guess they've got a whole entourage around. I don't know how they handle all that, but it's what you grow up with. And I guess today's players are used to having all that, what they call their team around them.
Yeah, that's right. It's always their team, isn't it? That's right. Pre-1968, John, give me a sense of what the game was like. I mean, there were no toilet breaks. There were no massive eskies out on the court, were there? In fact, I don't think you were even allowed to sit down at changeover, were you?
No, if you watched a replay of the 1970 final with Ken Rosewall that I played, you see that we were changing ends and there were no seats to sit on the change of ends. And, you know, you poured your own drink, which a little bit of Robinson's barley water. So, and there was no time limit on the change of ends, but you're expected to, you know, towel down and have a drink and then get on with it. Otherwise, the umpires said, you know, gave you a bit of a hurry up.
And you look at the amount of gear that they cart out of the court these days, and not just the eskies, of course, and massive bags of stuff. What did you come out with?
Probably three or four rackets.
Yeah.
Because we didn't break that many strings. We used gut in those, in the rackets, and maybe you'd have four rackets if you were playing on clay, because that was a little bit tougher on the strings. But that was about all you took out, and a towel.
Yeah, just speaking about rackets, I mean, those old wooden rackets, I mean, how do they compare? Because, you know, you would have hit the modern racket. What's the difference?
Oh, it's chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
The shots that they play today, if they tried to play those shots with the wooden racket, they'd break their arm,
yeah.
You know, or their wrist. So it's because of these rackets that, and the way that the strings are done now, that they hit the ball with a lot more strain on their elbows and their wrists and their shoulders, but they're able to do it because of the rackets, and with the way the rackets are strung today, they're able to impart a heck of a lot more spin on the ball.
Right.
So you can see they can hit the ball really hard, short across court, with a lot of spin, and it'll drop in still. Whereas that, if you went across court, you know, with a wooden racket in a heavily topspin shot, you couldn't hit it that hard, but you'd be able to get it to drop pretty quickly, but you couldn't hit it that hard.
Because, I mean, I suppose, too, that influenced the way that the game was played, too. I mean, back in your day, the serve and volley game was the style, wasn't that? I mean, these days, that's not, well, it can be played, but you typically see these long baseline rallies, particularly in men's tennis. Was that partly because of the racket, do you think?
Yeah, the answer to your question about serve and volley is yes and no. A lot of our play was on clay courts, playing all around Europe. And, of course, you know, if you wanted to serve and volley there all the time, you had to have a hell of a good serve and volley. So my best results on clay were when I'd learned to be able to, you know, realize that I could stay back and rally with the clay quarters, and then I could add the coming into the net and serving and volleying as the match went on. And that was when I had my best clay court results. But of course, we were brought up here in Sydney, all of my tennis until I was 12, was all on clay courts, the loan courts that we had here in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a mixture of a little bit of grass court tennis, and then all the competitions on the weekend were played on clay. So we had actually been brought up on clay.
Yeah.
Serve and volley was part of the Australian game back then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, these days, the modern surfaces, the rebound ace surfaces and so on, it is a different game. It's a different game in a social sense too. I remember Martina Navratilova wrote in her autobiography about when she travelled around the world. She just travelled with Chris Evert Lloyd. you'd never see that these days, would you?
No. They've got to have the entourage, the cheer squad. Some of them need the cheer squad there so that if things are going wrong, they can abuse the people in their players' box. No, I travelled a lot with Rochi.
Yeah.
You know, Tony and I, we went on our first private tour in 1965, not in a team. We played the Caribbean circuit, which was, well, great places, you know, the Trinidad, Mexico City, Barranquilla, Puerto Rico. and it was about an 8-week circuit, and I rode away to all the tournaments because we had no prize money then, and you weren't supposed to get any money, but I rode away to all the tournaments and said that we needed $500 or $600 a week plus accommodation. So that was supposed to be illegal to get the money, although you could get accommodation. So at the end of the tournament, whether you won the tournament or not, the tournament director you'd go into the office and he'd say, "I'll bet you $600 you can't jump across that line." And you jump across the line, they give you $600. So it was all legal.
Oh, that's a great story. That's a great story.
Roche and I played that whole circuit, and we were most weeks we were both in the singles final, and we were in the doubles final as well. So, and they were best of five sets, the matches.
Mm. I believe when you won your first Wimbledon, you got rich off that. You won a £50 voucher from Harrods.
Well, they gave me a £50 voucher, which I could then go and spend at one of the big stores in town.
Yeah.
And fortunately, one of the club members came up and gave me £50 for the voucher.
Oh, dear, I know. Well, did you ever worry about, they say that Ivan Lendl and Martina were probably the first players to really take note of aerobic fitness and diet. Do you remember ever worrying about what you ate before a game or what you ate generally?
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of, people to, they were the first players to do that. That's a lot of rubbish.
Right.
We had a very strict routine with a Davis Cup under Harry Hopman and, what we ate and our training. And nobody has ever trained harder than Roy Emerson. Emma was fantastically fit. And we did an enormous amount of physical training, which is one of the reasons that Australian players won so much. And that all started after the Second World War with Frank Sedgman. And as I just said, we were playing tournaments where the finals would be best of five sets and then the doubles final would be best of five sets. And you'd play them one after another. So, you needed to be extremely fit to do that.
Yes, I remember some other players saying that, actually, when they first joined the tour, even in relatively modern times, that a lot of players didn't put that much in, as it were. That if you did apply yourself, you could actually get somewhere.
It was quite amazing. The Aussie players who hadn't been around Davis Cup teams, and when they would get into a squad and they saw what we were doing, and you could see, and they started doing it. You'd see 6 months later their results would pick up dramatically. But we had an off season of. At the beginning of the year for 3 weeks where we'd all go into the gym, didn't play much tennis, but did very extensive training in the gym. Not a lot of big weights or anything like that, but a heck of a lot of work on your legs and your inner core.
Okay.
A lot of wind sprints and long distance running, a mixture of those two things. So you'd start off the tour, in pretty good physical shape, and then if you lost early in a tournament, you'd do extra training, away from the tennis court.
Sure.
Yeah.
John Newcombe's with us, the great Australian tennis player. We're talking about how tennis has changed over the years. What about the way the way the game's played, John? Sometimes you see modern players, trying to blast their opponent off the court just by hitting the ball harder and harder and harder. The age-old game of tennis was, of course, about placing the ball where your opponent wasn't. And that surely hasn't changed. Well, you see some of the old techniques, the slice backhand and so on, still popular today too. How do you think the way the game's played has changed?
Oh, I found a lot of the matches boring, quite frankly. Where they're just hitting the ball as hard as they can from the back of the court. Sharapova became particularly boring to watch. She never changed the game, just hit the ball as hard as she could. A player like Serena can be quite interesting to watch because she's a little bit inventive how she tries to open up the court. Alex de Minaur is, you know, he's fun to watch because he has to work the points. But they're just standing at the back of the court, and you know, they're beautiful shots,
yep.
And it's wonderful to see how they have control and they can hit the, you know, brilliant winners. But it's like one point is the same as the next.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of inventive stuff of, you know, playing the game like a game of chess.
Yeah.
Where you're opening up the court to create a short ball so that you can come into the net. So you don't see a lot of that. The few players that you do, you know, the public really respond to it. And, of course, Federer is one of those.
Yeah.
That he uses the whole court in his game. And Nadal does to a certain extent too.
You were famous for jumping the net after the game and immediately thanking your opponent. I wondered two things. Were you ever worried when you trip that you trip over? And these days, of course, when someone wins, they immediately lie down, don't they?
Yeah, I know. We can't stand that. Because there was a stage, Philip, though, that I realised, don't try to jump the net anymore. You may not make it. And when I realised that, I didn't do it anymore. Otherwise, you're going to look pretty stupid.
I was going to say, it wouldn't be a good look, John.
you know, when Roche and I, we had the Davis Cup team there, we were running it for 7 years in the 94 to 2000. And when our guys, you know, won a really big match, if they started to run over to the side, you know, I'd stop them.
Yeah.
And I'd say, no, go straight to your opponent.
Yeah.
And shake hands and that, so I kind of find the lying down on the court when the match is over, I find it not courteous to your opponent.
Mm.
You know, the first thing you've both been out there in theatre.
Yeah.
You know, it's like theatre and the play's finished.
Yeah.
And you're both heroes.
Yeah.
So run up to the net, shake your opponent's hand, win or lose, look him in the eye. And if you've won and you're really happy, then do hooplas, lay down on the court, do whatever you want. But the first thing you have to do is acknowledge your opponent. You've been out there for, gosh sakes, 4 hours or more sometimes in combat. You know, this is, you've been intertwined together. You have to acknowledge that fact at the end of the match. And the other thing that I don't like is, you know, that you finish a 4-hour match and the player that wins goes and sits down, then goes out on the court and salutes the crowd.
Mm.
And the loser after 4 hours is sitting there with their head down.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd had a 4-hour match with someone and I wanted to go out on court, I would go and get my opponent's arm and I would take him out there with me and salute the crowd together. You know, unless I didn't like the guy.
Yeah.
and then I wouldn't do it, but there weren't many of those.
No. Oh, it's been wonderful chatting, John, and terrific to have you. Memories of the game as well, and here to you on your attitude towards good sportsmanship as well. Thanks so much for your time, John.
My pleasure, Philip.
Yeah, mine indeed, and I'm sure every listener too. John Newcombe, tennis great, joining us there on the program. I don't know, Todd, is he right about the lying down on the court?
yeah, look, it's been a massive influence in my whole tennis career. Yeah. Many of the things he was talking about post with his coaching in Davis Cup, I was involved in. And when I finished, I was lucky enough to call Wimbledon finals with him for the Seven Network. So those were some pretty great moments. But he was a wonderful captain to play with in Davis Cup. I played with Neil Fraser as a captain, John Newcombe and John Fitzgerald in my time playing for Australia. And Nuke had the most creative mind as a captain, where he would allow you to use all of your talent. I like to talk tactics and things when I played, and he used to draw the very best out of me I grew enormously from having him sit on the side of the court. And that was one of the beauties of Davis Cup, where you could rely on a captain to put your head back into the right place. And I did need that occasionally.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Todd Woodbridge is with us, Australian tennis champ. We always look back a bit to the golden age of Australian tennis. Oh, by the way, I'll take some calls in a second too for Alan and Anne, who are waiting too. We always look back to the golden age a bit, don't we, Todd? But right now we've got a female number one, Ash Barty. Who are the most promising male players, do you think? Alex de Minaur, of course?
Well, yes. Yeah, Alex de Minaur, as you heard you talk about, he had a very good US Open just now, his best result in a major tournament, reaching the quarterfinals. Still got a lot of development to go. I talked about the physicality. He has to do a lot to build a bigger, stronger body to get more on it, to be able to hit it harder, belt it, like you mentioned. And then we've got another youngster, the same age, named Alexei Popyrin. Who also the last 2 years has done very well, come through the majors, winning matches as a teenager, which is hard to do in this era. He hasn't played a lot since the Australian Open due to all the situations and things that have been happening. But those two are the future at this point of what we're looking for. So both 21, so still plenty of time ahead of them on the men's side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Ash Barty can maintain what she's doing for 5 or 10 years, she's going to win many more majors, I think. So it's just as long as for her is about keeping her motivation.
Yeah. I remember speaking to Pat Rafter a while back, Todd, and one of the things he was saying was that, you know, you get kids at 12 age, this is boys and girls, at age sort of, you know, between 10 and 12 or 13 or so, who are often quite good. It's getting them to stay with it through their teen years that's the toughest thing. Well, we're a small country. We've got a great tennis history. Are there too many things on offer? Is it going to be tougher to produce tennis champs, do you think?
I do. I think it is going to be harder. And I think one of the things that we've got to realise is, you know, when Nuke is talking about in his career, tennis was played almost by the Anglo-style type countries. Yeah. You know, your Great Britain, United States, your French, your four majors, and you had South Africa thrown into there. And then Eastern Europe opened up. You know, when I first started on tour, there were only two players allowed out of Czechoslovakia to come and play the tournaments with us, and that would have been the same in Nuke's day. Mm. And then the Berlin Wall came down, and then it opened up that whole eastern side of Europe, and there's so many great players were sitting there waiting to come. And the game of tennis really is now so much more global than it was before, even though you travelled around the world. It's changed because of that. So that's going to make it much harder. And then, you know, we just go back to the social fabric of what we do in Australia now, how much that's changed. A lot of people go to the mall instead of going to play sport on the weekend, and shop, and social media and computers and iPads and things have changed the way kids do things. And there's so many more options for them, and they'll try them all, and by the time they finish trying them all, they're kind of not interested in any of them, and that's a real shame.
Sure. No, I think that's probably right. Yep. Okay, look, let's take a call or two. We're with Todd Woodbridge. We're talking about Australian tennis. Gary from Kingsford. G'day, Gary.
Yes. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
I'm writing a book, Phil, and I've done a little bit of a piece of what paragraph about John Newcombe, if I could share it.
Yeah, go on.
John Newcombe, or Nuke, as he's affectionately known, was the Errol Flynn of tennis. This good-natured, moustachioed larrikin of the Aussie variety had a powerful serve volley game, ideally suited to the grass courts of Wimbledon and Kooyong. Who will ever forget the way he used to leap over the net at the conclusion of his matches to shake hands with his adversaries? Today's protagonists need to take a leaf out of Nuke's book. Tennis must be played in the right spirit, something the affable Nuke will long be admired for.
Yeah. Well, chin to that, Gary.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's the old Nuke's phrase, isn't it? It was Beauty Nuke, which was his catchphrase in commercials.
So, that's right. Beauty Nuke, chin. Yeah. <That's right. laughs> He made an unfashionable drink fashionable. Put it that way. Look at that. hello, Anne. Hi, Anne.
Oh, hi, Phil. Yeah. Can I just acknowledge Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley too?
Of course, yeah.
Because she was a great inspiration. And I wanted to just say, well, my mum used to knock about a ball when they were 14 with Kenny Rosewell at Bexley.
Oh, yeah.
And the sad thing about that court is that it's where they used to play in Bexley. I think it's on Harrow Road. It's all falling down. It's not been maintained, and it's sad that we're not keeping our sporting history. But I also think that there were tennis courts everywhere. There was, they were in every school, they were in every block, they were free, they were open. We used to go up and knock about a ball in the school yard on Saturday afternoon. But kids don't do that these days.
No, they don't. They don't actually. Yes, Todd?
And they don't ride their bikes to the court.
Todd?
Anne's touched on, you talk about Bexley and that's the Illawarra suburbs where I grew up playing. And I grew up playing on backyard courts. So all of my early competition tennis, where I played Saturday morning juniors and Saturday afternoon, I from the age of 10, my mum put me in her team to go and play in the adult. We went round all of the St. George Sutherland Shire on backyard courts. And the unfortunate thing, because of real estate prices, is that the majority of those courts that I used to play on are now gone. And that is one of the factors that that tennis has had to face, is that courts have disappeared in the bigger cities because of real estate prices, and we've had to find different ways to get people to be able to get on court.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Alan in Perth. G'day, Al.
Good evening, Phil.
Hi.
Thank you for the opportunity. And pleasure. I would like to start by saying thanks to Todd as well, because the Woodies were my mother's favourite tennis players, and they gave her a lot of pleasure in her later years.
There was Mark. There was Mark Woodbridge. Who was the other one again, Al?
Well, those were the days.
Sorry,
weren't they?
Sorry, Todd.
No. But Alan talks about doubles combos, and you know we had so many wonderful ones. You had Newcomb and Roach. You had Sedgman and McGregor, and you had the Supermax, McNamara, McNamee. We were just following on from all of these greats in those times.
Yes, too true. I would like, if I might, to read you a short paragraph out of a book that was published in the Williams District. It's just called The Williams. It was written by one Hertel Cowan, who worked in the road board there. And it mentions a couple of my relatives, that's all. It's only 10 lines. I'll preface it by saying the previous paragraph mentioned the 1930s. And it says, about this period, the well-known property Glenfield again changed ownership, this time to a Victorian, Edwin Noske, a descendant of the South Australian and Victorian flour milling firm of Noske Brothers. Ted Noske was an energetic person and an efficient farmer. Besides wool and grain, his farming activities centred about meat production. He was a very good golfer, but really excelled on the tennis court. Prior to his coming to Williams, Ted Noske had been one-time champion of South Yarra, and had won the Kooyong singles title 3 years in succession. And it finished by saying his son David had farming interest in the Williams district as well.
There you go. Thanks, Al. Thanks, Al. Thanks for the memories too. Todd, have you been enduring the lockdown? Because you're down in Melbourne, aren't you?
I am in Melbourne. Yes, look, it's been okay. I have enjoyed the tennis coming back. I mean, it was a long break. Tennis struggled more than really any other sport because of that global nature to get the US Open up. And to be able to talk and watch and get back to, that, that was a big relief. And I look forward to getting back out and hitting a few balls myself, I must say.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, are you any good at golf, Todd? I've played with quite a few tennis players who are quite good at golf. There's a theory that people are good at bat and ball games, like tennis, can play any bat and ball game. Is that right?
Well, I love golf. It's my passion now after tennis. And I've got myself down to a 3 handicap.
Here's more evidence to my theory. You are good at golf.
It's funny, though, because I play, most tennis players I know that play golf, they play exactly the same way tactically that they play tennis. So my serve was a little dodgy. I didn't hit it that hard, which is like my game off the tee. Get me in and around the greens and I'm putting, I'm a bit like making a lot of really good low volleys and finishing things up at net. That's my analogy.
Dear. Yvonne in Benalla says, Phil, let's just be basic. When John Newcombe was playing, his biggest claim to fame across all sports among women, of which there were many, was being voted as having the best bum in the business. Thank you, Yvonne. That's right. I'm not even sure you're allowed to say
that. I thought she was going with the moustache as well. But I think it was Anne touched on Yvonne Guillaume-Cawley, who obviously we didn't talk a lot about, but you mentioned earlier that the US Open that I won 30 years ago with Liz Smiley, Yvonne actually took Liz and I back into New York in a beautiful big stretch limo. She was a guest of the tournament. I'd never been in a limo before, and that was one of the treats after winning the trophy that day. So that's where all that Aussie connection always sort of sticks together.
What marvellous memories and connections too. Todd, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've run out of time, but that's just the way it is.
Fantastic. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, really appreciate your time, Todd. Thanks, mate.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bye-bye. Todd Woodbridge, champion Australian player, was one half of the Woodies. Yeah, that was fun. We are good at it. We will. Beauty Nuke, exactly. A testament to great sports and sportsmanship too, together with our guests, Casey Delacqua and Todd Woodbridge.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.